It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. It can feel like we're living in an unpredictable time, but we're often expected to respond to complicated events with fully formed, clear-cut decisions and opinions, and fast. According to our next guest, though, there can be a lot of wisdom in saying, I'm not sure. In a new book, she looks into science, medicine, computer technology, and more, and says there's a lot to gain when we embrace uncertainty. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you feel like you're someone who embraces or avoids uncertainty in your life? Do you feel anxiety or maybe like you're paralyzed in decision-making in uncertain situations? Do you have questions about the latest science in how our brains deal with uncertainty? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Maggie Jackson is an award-winning author and journalist. Her newest book is called Uncertain, The Wisdom and Wonder of Being Unsure. Maggie, thanks a lot for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
Now, you have a track record in your books at Journalism, Maggie, of pursuing kind of off-the-beaten-path topics. What led you down the path of uncertainty?
Well, I kind of backed into the topic, actually. It was an uncertain beginning. But after I wrote a book called Distracted, which is about the science of attention and the erosion of focus in the society, I thought, well, what's the complement to focus? Well, thinking. So I kind of set off to write a book about what kinds of thinking we need in this fragmented, speed-driven age. The first chapter happened to be about uncertainty. And so I discovered two things. One, uncertainty was a lot more than just a chapter. But secondly, I discovered an incredible wealth of new research that actually is beginning to reveal how it works in our brain or why it is doesn't lead to great, you know, doctoring and, you know, what does daydreaming have to do with uncertainty? I discovered a lot of new science basically revealing uncertainty's wisdom, even though we think of it as this sort of shameful flaw to be unsure.
And you mentioned new research here. There hadn't been a lot of research on uncertainty. I think the default assumption was uncertainty is a bad thing that we can avoid and or ignore. We've treated uncertainty as a negative for a lot of our history.
Right, exactly. Because mainly because humans do need and want answers. And so that's an important starting point. But as well, our culture, even for hundreds of years, especially in the industrial age, has been very efficiency oriented. So achieving the task or getting to the outcome has kind of taken up the dominant attention in science. And even psychology was ignoring this liminal zone of being unsure, which is really about the space between the question and the answer. Scientists would give, early scientists would give MRI scanners to people, and they would completely ignore what people were doing, what their brains were doing when they were between tasks. It was really just about whether they did the task well or not. That's how one of the most major networks related to daydreaming was discovered by accident, because people's brains actually are far more active when they're doing nothing, even when they're listening to silence, than they are when they're doing goal-oriented kind of work.
One thing that I really took away from your book, Maggie, is that in that time of uncertainty, when we're not sure what our response is or our decision, there's a lot going on that can be really valuable in helping us make that decision. What is going on in our brains at the moment that we can potentially harness?
Yes, the first important starting point is that uncertainty is good stress. Well, I mentioned that we need and want answers. So basically, we're geared to, when we meet up with something new or unexpected or ambiguous, we have a stress response. So you get a memo from the boss, or you get a traffic jam on a stretch of road where you've never had one before. And, you know, your heart might beat, your cortisol levels might go up. But at the same time, and this is the new science, your brain becomes more receptive to new data. Your attention improves. So scientists talk about curious eyes, and your working memory is bolstered. There's just a cascading effect from stress hormones that are actually related to what scientists call arousal, and I call wakefulness. So basically, as one neuroscientist told me, that's when you're uncertain, the brain is telling itself there's something to be learned here. So the unease is not something to be retreated from. It's actually an invitation to learn. And I just read a new study about doctors who were asked about sticky moments after they finished their clinical shifts. And lo and behold, the uncertain moments when they really didn't know what to do and it was stressful and it was difficult, those were the moments when their attention was heightened. And also they began to look ahead to see what resources they needed to fix the problem. So actually we wake up when we're uncertain. That's a really important kind of re-envisioning of what uncertainty is.
Maggie Jackson is with us talking about her new book. It's called Uncertain, The Wisdom and Wonder of Being Unsure. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think there's too much emphasis on being quickly decisive in different parts of our lives? Have you found ways to take those uncertain moments and learn from them? Join in at 800-642-1234. Maggie, you queued me up perfectly for an example I wanted to take out of your book. You were just talking about doctors. One of the most vivid scenes is you are observing a liver tumor surgery. Now, I would think somebody who's operating on a complicated piece of our human equipment in a difficult situation, I would think I want them to be bold and decisive and take that next move without thinking about it. Those kind of surgeons are embracing uncertainty to avoid errors. Can you talk us through what they're learning?
Right, exactly. Well, I went up to Toronto to visit surgeons and actually observe surgeries. I was in the operating room right next to the patient, and I was sort of looking to see whether uncertainty had a place when the situation was highly stressed and speed-driven, et cetera, because that's what our image of great expertise is. It's the sort of swaggering, efficient person who strides into the room or walks onto the, you know, scene of the fire and immediately knows what to do. But actually, it turns out that that's really a particular kind of expertise. So when you're learning, you gain expertise through those thousands of hours of practice, and you begin to know what to do in situations that you've seen before. You begin to rely on the heuristic shortcut thinking. But what really often happens is that those routine experts, when they're faced with a new problem, actually begin to fail because they're trotting out the old solutions. So years of experience are actually only weakly correlated or not correlated at all with accuracy in many, many different fields. I think in journalism, you know, just like the military or finance, we've seen the person who's seen it all before and they're still trotting out the same old story. Senior auditors, for example, actually are less good at finding embezzlement in the books than young students who are studying accounting. But the better kind of expertise is actually the person who's adaptive. Those kind of experts spend more time diagnosing a problem than even novices, because as I write in the book, they inhabit the question. They're, you know, forever testing. They widen their options. And so this is the kind of expertise that's really important when you're faced with a new situation. And, you know, my surgeon that I was witnessing in the operating room, he actually kind of came to a really terrible near miss that he luckily didn't do this terrible cutting of the bile duct, but it was a close call because he was all swagger. And as another surgeon told me, he was treating it like it was all routine. And that's not how we are able to better, you know, fix problems when they're new and complicated.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Georgia is with us in Madison. Hi there, Georgia.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about?
I have a fridge magnet. It's a quote from Annie Lamott, and it says, "The opposite of faith is not doubt, it's certainty." And I just wondered if your guest would have a comment about that.
Interesting. Annie is a fine guest to talk to. She's been on this show before. Georgia, thanks for that. You talk about a lot of different sources, philosophical, scientific, and others, Maggie, who are saying, certainty is sometimes an obstacle more than anything.
Right, exactly. And I think that's true whether or not you're talking about spheres of faith or whether you're in the workplace or what have you. And I think that, you know, people often ask me about the questions about faith, and I'm not a religious scholar by any means, and I didn't write about religion in the book. But I think that Knowledge, when you are comfortable with uncertainty, is flexible and something that's constantly changing, constantly being built upon. You know, people who are really tolerant of uncertainty, and that's a psychological term, are actually more flexible thinkers who are more curious, and they treat knowledge as a kind of mutable tapestry whose strength is in the fact that it's constantly changing and growing. Whereas people who are intolerant, you know, that means fearful of the unknown, are treat knowledge as a rock that's there to defend, you know, and that's, those are two very, very different approaches to uncertainty. Because what I'm talking about here is not, there are two types of uncertainty that we should all, I should also preface to define what I mean by uncertainty. I mean, we've been talking about the psychology of uncertainty. Well, when we say uncertainty roils the stock markets, that's really a shorthand for the unknown. That's a shorthand for what we cannot know. And so, you know, you might get the great weather report with the probabilistic reasoning about how much snow is going to be dumped in your backyard next Tuesday, but you don't know whether it's 6 or 8 inches. Nobody knows. And that's the unknown, the uncertainty. But there's a different kind of uncertainty, which is the human response to the unknown. And that's where we can really change our attitudes and harness the wisdom of uncertainty. That's basically the human ability to recognize when they reach the limits of their knowledge. And isn't that a good thing to recognize when you reach the end of your knowledge? And then you can go forth from there. So I think that has a lot to do with both faith and everything else in life.
Georgia, thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to journalist and author Maggie Jackson. Her new book is Uncertain, The Wisdom and Wonder of Being Unsure. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you found ways to embrace uncertainty over the course of your life? Was there a decision that you made, or maybe you made with a committee or other group, where, you know, the certain obvious answer wasn't the right one in hindsight? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our conversation with Maggie Jackson about her new book, Uncertain, The Wisdom and Wonder of Being Unsure. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you feel pressure to have and express a position about complicated current events? Do you feel like uncertainty is rewarded or punished in today's climate? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Maggie, before we go back to our callers, I want to talk about kind of the incentive structure of our media and social media these days. It seems like in the media, you're supposed to have a hot take, a certain position to share with others. Same with social media or comments on an article. The people who have strong, decisive opinions are going to speak up. The people who aren't sure, they may not go online to type, I don't know how I feel about this. Are we weighting things away from embracing uncertainty?
Well, I think we are. And actually, there's new evidence that shows that the penetration or the adoption of both the internet and smartphones is related to or correlated with higher intolerance of uncertainty among young people. So people are more fearful of the unknown because they're living lives in a virtual sphere where there's hardly any practice with being uncertain, as you were just saying. And in fact, you know, many, many studies show this is the case. Just a brief search online is actually related to people emerging, thinking they know more than they do. Well, of course, when you're searching for something, hey, you're learning. So what's wrong with that? You think you know more than you. Well, actually, that's extremely a corrosive to learning itself. And if you really always think that you know more than you do, because the you're kind of wedded to this world of knowledge that's endless and limited, and there's always an instant answer, then you're really not going to be able to know what you need to know next. And that's very important. That kind of Google hubris is really toxic. So I think that the internet and the where we live, you know, looks and feels very neat and pat. And of course, the tempo is one single tempo, instant answers. And that breeds what I think is a sort of over experiencing of heuristic thinking, that kind of shortcut thinking based on the past, based on what you know. We kind of gravitate toward, and the internet pushes us toward what's familiar, what's safe, what's the echo chamber. That again is just heuristic thinking. Whereas what is uncertainty? It's basically moves you away from autopilot. It moves you to the edge of what you know. And then there's a whole new frontier of growth and thriving. And in fact, being comfortable in uncertainty is actually correlated with resilience. If people are actually training people, psychologists are training people to be more tolerant of uncertainty, to treat anxiety, to treat a depression, to treat worry and many different mental disorders. Because if you can contend with uncertainty with skill, then you can contend with life, which is, of course, always going to be unpredictable and volatile and mutable.
Let's go back to our callers now. David is with us in Price County. David, hi.
Hey, hi. And hooked up with what you just were saying, Maggie, I think of it in terms of the concept of time, that you're uncertain now, but as you explore, maybe take some baby steps toward it, but are uncertain. But over time, the truth comes out that you're going down the right path or not, and you can change and you can be adaptable, like you were saying. So I wonder if you could speak more to that idea of, and right, in our hyper vigilant society today of always wanting the answer right now, and that's it. No, that's not the way it is.
David, thanks a lot for that call. Maggie, the idea of taking time to sit with that uncertainty.
Yes, I think that's such a great point, David. And in fact, it's really important I think of an uncertainty as not only a form of honesty because it's waking you up to the world, but it's also an investment. I mean, the second most important part of uncertainty, other than this arousal, this wakefulness that spurs you into better thinking, is that it's a space of possibility. It is, as I was saying, the opening up between the question and the answer. And one of the most wonderful examples of this is just the value of a pause for our memory and for gaining insight. It's really stunning now that when people pause, and I mean really just pause, not do anything, if they're pausing after learning, saying, passages of prose, and in an experiment, half the people just jump onto a video game as a kind of break, and others do nothing and don't even think about what they just learned. That actually allows the memories to be encoded into your mind. So a 5-minute pause boosts your memory for what you just learned by about 25%, which is stunning, even in people with Alzheimer's. And it's also related to these kinds of pauses, this doing nothing, this kind of living, stop the goal-oriented, stop the instant and answer sort of business. You're actually helping your mind gain insight because your brain is curating and sifting and sorting that information, making connections. And that's what sleep and dreaming do in more fertile ways than even during the daytime. It's not a time of nothingness, the pause.
Thanks for that call. We are talking to Maggie Jackson about her new book, Uncertain, The Wisdom and Wonder of Being Unsure. Back to your calls. James is with us in Milwaukee. James, hi.
Hello there. I speak as one who faced a lot of uncertainty starting when I was 17. That's when I began to lose my sight. And a lot of uncertainty comes with that because you have to adapt to things and you don't know what's going to come next, and you have to go on. And nevertheless, I embraced the uncertainty and kept going. I lost my sight when I was 27, but by that time, I'd enrolled in the UW system. I enrolled in UW Milwaukee. And
James, I'm sorry, we're just about out of time, but thanks a lot for the call. And you look at some people in the book, Maggie, who had a loss of a faculty that they may have had. In one case, it was somebody who lost the ability to calculate precise numbers, things like that. Dealing with uncertainty in a situation like James's or others where there's a big change like that and how we adapt.
Yes, exactly. And I think it's really important to understand that there are limits to big limits to uncertainty. It's not the panacea. I'm not saying, oh, let's all be uncertain. There's a limit to uncertainty. You know, you don't want to remain in uncertainty all the time. It has its wonderful powers for when things are new and unexpected. But also, we don't want people to be uncertain about the core, their survival or whether their next meal is coming from. And yet, I would argue that uncertainty is a human right, because when you have the ability and the skill and the power and the time to be unsure a little bit, as we've been talking about, it's investment in future. And I think that was a wonderful, courageous story that James told about his accommodation and adaptation to his site and through learning to embrace uncertainty. Thank you so much for that.
Thanks for the call, James. And just our last minute, Maggie, leave us with a tip. When we feel that discomfort of uncertainty, how can we steer it down and make something of it?
Sure. Lean into uncertainty. That means know that it's uneasy, but the difference between people who can tolerate uncertainty and those who can't are that the people who tolerate it see it as a challenge. Lean into it. Know it's going to be stressful and expect the world to change, and then the possibilities open up. Don't see it as a threat, because actually, it's not the uncertainty that's the threat. It's our fear that's holding us back.
Maggie, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Maggie Jackson, award-winning author and journalist. We've been talking about her newest book. It's called Uncertain, The Wisdom and Wonder of Being Unsure. Still time for you to share your stories about dealing with uncertainty, for better or worse, or your tips for dealing with it. You can email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up in a few minutes is this week's edition of Food Friday. First, it's time for Wisconsin Life. As the saying goes, home is where the heart is. But for writer BJ Hollers, it's a little more complicated than that. We can become deeply connected to our physical home, so moving and moving on can be a process.
As the saying goes, home is where the heart is. But for writer BJ Hollers, it's a little more complicated than that. We can become deeply connected to our physical homes, so moving and moving on can be a process.
While my family and I have cherished our time in Eau Claire, it's time for us to say goodbye. The boxes are packed, the papers are signed. All that's left is to bid you farewell as we embark upon the next chapter of our journey. A journey, I'm pleased to add, that will take us no further than 1.9 miles from our current home. Yet, sentimentalist that I am, any move, even one that lands us in the same zip code, leaves me awash with emotion. Over the past month, while attempting to box up our belongings, I regularly pumped the packing brakes to indulge in various unplanned detours down memory lane, including a writing worksheet I found crumpled in my 7-year-old daughter's room shortly before our scheduled move. She composed several sentences about the move, including, "My house is along the highway. I've been to my new house." But then, in a stunning twist, her declarative statements veered toward the philosophical. Why does the world move so fast? The moment she got home from school, I accosted her. "Where on earth did you come up with that line?" I asked, handing her the paper. "Duh," she said, rolling her eyes, "only from every adult ever." If there's one thing adults do well, it's lamenting the fast passage of time. Unfortunately, we're less adept at finding ways to slow it. Let me be clear. I never wanted to move, Instead, I'd hoped to root myself as deeply to the land as our backyard river birch tree. But my wife had insisted that the children required bedrooms and bathrooms, and eventually logic won the day. My begrudging agreement came with conditions. I demanded that our new house be within walking distance of our old house. I wanted to avoid all bidding wars, and I didn't want to sell our former house to just anyone. Such stringent conditions, I figured, would buy me a little more time. Instead, the universe conspired on my wife's behalf, rolling out a tailor-made red carpet that made short work of my conditions. One afternoon, the grandparents of a family friend mentioned that they were hoping to downsize. Their home was just the right size and just the right neighborhood, a mere 5,800 steps away from our current home. Within a month, we'd struck a deal. The only bidding war involved me demanding that I pay a little more to make things closer to fair. With two out of three conditions met, all that remained was finding the perfect buyers for our own home. This being a seller's market, I had the luxury of vetting all interested parties. Following an extensive 37-year process, I found the perfect people. Or rather, they found me. "Wait a minute," I said into the phone. "You mean to tell me that you and Dad would move here?" "Yes," my mother agreed. "There's nothing we want more." After missing one too many of their grandchildren's activities, my parents were anxious to make the 500-mile journey from Indiana to embark upon their own next chapter with us. Now, if this all seems a little too good to be true, it's because it is. I'm still waiting for the other shoe to drop. Will the basement flood? Will the roof cave in? Whatever the price, we'll pay it. Because we have found not only the perfect house, but the perfect arrangement too. We lose nothing, and we gain grandparents. Was it Heraclitus or my 7-year-old who said, "The only constant in life is change"? Whomever it was, they were right. While change is scary, it's less so when you know it's coming. And since it's always coming, we ought never to be afraid. When one door closes, another opens. All the better when you've got familiar faces waiting within.
BJ Hollers is a writer, author, and assistant professor of creative writing at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org, on Facebook, and on Instagram. I'm Brad Colbert.
This is Central Time. Ramadan starts on Sunday. Ramadan's the ninth month on the Islamic calendar, and many Muslims fast during this time. Fasting happens from sunrise to sunset, so two meals are eaten each day, one at dawn, one at dusk. Traditional Ramadan foods include dates and lentil soups, but dishes vary all over the world. It's Food Friday, and our guest's Ramadan recipes have a mix of Indian, Pakistani, British, and other influences. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Are you getting ready to observe Ramadan yourself? What are your favorite foods as part of that? Or at the end of it, do you have favorite Middle Eastern and or South Asian foods? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. Zeina Din is the author of the cookbook, Desified, Delicious Recipes for Ramadan, Eid, and Every Day. You can follow her on Instagram at Zeina's Bakes. Zeina, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Of course. Thank you so much for having me.
Can you tell us about the before sunrise and after sunset meals that go on during Ramadan? What is special about those?
So the before sunrise meal is essentially our breakfast, and it's like the final thing we can eat and drink before the fasting begins. And usually the meal will include things like long-lasting carbs, lots of protein, nothing too salty because you want to try and reduce, how thirsty you're going to get in the day. And then our evening meal, so the sunset meal, we also called iftar, which is our dinner. And really, you can eat anything at all, but usually it's dishes from your culture, so they could be rice dishes, curry, chicken, things like that.
And as I mentioned, you were just getting at there, there's a lot of variety. There are Muslims in countries all over the world. Are there foods that you found that everybody sees as part of the Ramadan repertoire, the Ramadan meals, or is it really different from one region to another?
I think every region has different cultural dishes. So I'm South Asian, I'm Pakistani, and we have a lot of curries and grilled meat, whereas someone from North Africa or the Middle East will have different types of rice dishes. But one thing which is common across most cultures is dates and rose syrup.
Let's start with those early day meals now. I understand your go-to breakfast during Ramadan is Turkish eggs. Tell us a little bit about this recipe.
Yes, I love Turkish eggs. It's such a simple dish and it's very high in protein. So it starts with a base of a really thick yogurt with a couple of poached eggs on top and then a chili butter. So it's traditionally a Turkish dish, but I've desified it, which means I've put my South Asian spin on it using a few more spices.
What are those extra spices?
Chili powder, garam masala, turmeric, and those three spices are key ingredients to a lot of South Asian dishes.
And then another breakfast is, I understand, souvian. This is a sweet dish, but there are noodles involved. It ends up being like a pudding, I guess?
Yeah, so that's souvian, and it's a very common dish, actually, and lots of different cultures have different ways of cooking it. But it's like a milky pudding. So imagine a rice pudding, but instead of rice, it's made with vermicelli noodles. And we often eat this actually for Eid, for breakfast. But you can also have it for dessert because it is quite sweet.
I want to step away from the recipes for a moment. Talk a little bit about how you started sharing Ramadan recipes on Instagram and how it ended up evolving into this new cookbook.
Well, it's a funny story, actually. So my Instagram page, Zainab Bakes, I started when I was 16 as a school project, and this was about 8 years ago now. And then I actually fell into a tech career. So I worked at Facebook and Instagram and TikTok for about 5 years. And then 3 years ago, so during lockdown, I started a content series called Ramadan Recipes, where I cooked 30 recipes for 30 days of fasting, and it basically blew up online. I quit my job and I decided let's just do food full time because that's my true passion. And I kind of went with the momentum and I kept sharing my recipes and some traditional recipes that have been passed down to me from my mum. And then I was approached by a book agent and I recently published Desified and the rest is history.
Now let's go to the evening. Now I imagine after a day of fasting, food sounds like a really good thing, right? The appetite is ready to rock after the day of fasting.
Do you know what? Funnily enough, because we've been fasting all day, well, for me personally, I won't speak on behalf of everyone, but I actually find it difficult to eat for that first meal. And obviously you're starving. You really want to eat. You really want to indulge in your food, but you just have to ease into it because your stomach has kind of shrunk, your appetite has shrunk, and as the days go on your stomach is getting smaller and smaller, but by the time it then comes to your morning meal, then I'm ready to eat. That's when I eat most of my
funny.
Food actually.
Are there foods that, so when you're in that transition zone, like I know I need to eat something but I'm not feeling it just yet, is there a good starter food that you like to go with?
So actually, the reason why dates are so important is not because, well, they're very good for you. First of all, they're high in fiber and high in sugar, so it brings your blood sugar level back up to where it should be quickly. But also, in our religion, our Prophet Muhammad used to open his fast by eating one or three dates. So it also has a religious significance there as well, which is why so many Muslims start their fast with dates.
It's Food Friday. We're talking about Ramadan recipes with Zainab Din, author of the new cookbook, Desified, Delicious Recipes for Ramadan, Eid, and Every Day. You can follow her on Instagram at Zainab's Bakes, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions you want to know about traditional Ramadan and not-so-traditional Ramadan recipes? Are you getting ready to observe yourself? What kind of foods do you associate with this part of the calendar? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our Food Friday talk with Zainab Din, author of the new cookbook, Desified, Delicious Recipes for Ramadan, Eid, and Every Day. You could join in at 800-642-1234. If you observe Ramadan, you're getting ready to. Are there foods you associate with the morning or evening meals? Do you have questions for our guest about the kinds of foods that might be part of those meals? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Zaina, before we get back to some more recipes, I saw on your Instagram a bit of etiquette related to Ramadan. If people know someone who's Muslim and sees them eating during the day during Ramadan, I wouldn't think of doing this, but you make a point on your Instagram. Don't ask. There's a lot of reasons. They're very personal. Can you talk us through that a little?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think people have some misconceptions about Ramadan, but it's actually pretty flexible, I would say. Ramadan is fasting during Ramadan is compulsory for all healthy adult Muslims. So if you're a woman, for example, and you're on your period or you're pregnant or you're breastfeeding, you should not be fasting. Anyone in general, if you're in poor health or you're on some type of regular medication, you shouldn't be fasting. But the most important reason of all is that religion is personal and everyone is on their own journey. And we're not in a position to judge or question other people whether they're fasting or not, because Ramadan is a whole month and fasting is just one part of that. And the other parts are also equally as important, and that includes giving to charity and doing work in your community and praying often and kind of developing your relationship with God and stuff like that. So even if someone is not fasting, it doesn't mean that they're not observing Ramadan in other ways.
All right, let's get back to the food now. We're going to go to the end of the day now. One recipe you've got up there is the chili cheese garlic naan. This sounds fantastic to me. Zaina, tell us a little bit about this recipe.
Listen, this recipe, if you are not a cook, if you don't consider yourself a chef, you have to try this because it's literally about four ingredients. So the naan dough itself is made of two ingredients, and that is self-raising flour and plain yogurt. From that point, you can kind of dress the naan however you want. And what I like to do is fill it with cheese and then brush over a garlic butter. But you can add some chili, you can add some vegetables, you can add a pizza base, whatever you want. It's so simple and so delicious.
And so naan, when I'm at a restaurant that serves it or sometimes it's packaged in stores, I love that naan bread. It's that easy to make, two ingredients. Tell us a little bit about how we make it.
Oh, you just cut off at the end there. What did you say?
Oh, tell us how. So we've got the yogurt. We've got that self-rising flour. How do we make that naan?
All you do is put equal parts of both ingredients into a bowl, mix it together. And also the great thing about this recipe is that you don't need to let it rest and you don't need to let it rise. You can cook it straight away.
Excellent. And then we just bake it, or is it fried? How does that, what's the finish up there?
So you cook it on a dry frying pan. In South Asian households, we have a heavy bottom skillet called a tava. But if you don't have a tava, you can just use any old frying pan with no oil, no butter. Cook it dry on one side for 30 seconds, then place it under the broiler, I believe you call it. But over here in the UK, we call it a grill. And each naan takes total 1 minute to cook.
I got to do this. Okay, I thought it was way more complicated than that. I will try that sometime. We've got a lot of ones we could go to. Let's try a sweet recipe now. This one, pretzel, chocolate, nutty, date bark. There's our dates again, but with some ingredients I love, pretzels and chocolate. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I took inspiration of this recipe actually from a viral trend that I saw on TikTok called date bark, where people are slicing and laying out dates and drizzling chocolate over the top and hardening it. And then they snap it, break it into pieces, which is why they call it date bark. But my date bark recipe has a layer of dates, peanut butter on top, then dark chocolate, because I don't usually like dark chocolate, actually, but it really contrasts with the sweetness of the dates. And then I lay a layer of salty, crunchy pretzels over the top. So it has sweetness, saltiness, gooiness, and crunchiness all in one.
We're talking to Zaina Din, author of the cookbook, Decified, Delicious Recipes for Ramadan, Eid, and Every Day. It's Food Friday. We're getting some great inspiration from the region. Let's talk a little bit about Eid. First of all, can you tell us what Eid is and how it's celebrated?
So Eid, we actually have two Eids in the year, but this Eid marks the end of Ramadan. And it's just all about family and food and sharing and, of course, praying. So usually the day in the morning, the men in the family or everyone in the family will go to the mosque, to their local mosque to pray. And then after that, you just spend time with your family, usually get dressed up in traditional clothes, have some delicious food. And some people like to go out to enjoy their evenings at a restaurant. as well.
And as I understand it, this is, I think of this kind of like, you know, Polish Christmas Eve. If you're going to do food, this is when you're going to pull all the stops out and put out a lot of really interesting foods. Is that right?
Absolutely. All of the best recipes, the samosa, all of your pastries, all of your kebabs, the curries, the rice dishes, all of your favorite foods and the salad, all the extras. It's a massive feast.
And so what are some of your favorite things to eat and or cook for that Eid celebration?
Oh, God, I love to eat everything, personally. But one of my favorites will probably have to be a biryani, and we make it pretty much every single year. And if you don't know, a biryani is basically a rice dish, and it's layered of a spicy meat or chicken curry with layers of rice in between, and then it's all steamed together.
All right. And
it's usually,
oh, go ahead.
Oh, sorry. I was going to say it's usually served with a side dish of yogurt or a chutney and a salad.
All right. There's one more I wanted to look at. We've got an eggplant dish. You've got it as a keema stuffed aubergine. We call aubergines eggplants in the U.S. I don't know what keema is, though. Can you tell us what that is and how it works with the aubergine, the eggplant?
Yes, your pronunciation was perfect, actually. So keema is our name for spicy minced meat, and it's usually in the form of a curry, but you could also just use it as a term to describe minced meat in general.
So what kind of meats would go in there?
It could be anything. You could have ground chicken, you could have ground beef. Sometimes we use mutton and lamb, and that would be the keema.
Okay. And then it's stuffed the eggplant, and then is that baked ultimately?
It's baked, yes. So you stuff the keema into the eggplant and you sear it off so it just holds its shape and holds together. Then you lay it into a dish of a really garlicky tomato sauce and you bake it all in the oven together. So all of the meat juices and the aubergine all gets infused into the sauce and it's delicious.
And then let's end with another dessert you've got. And I understand this is a fusion of classic Indian and classic English desserts. Sticky toffee gulab jamun. Am I saying that right?
Yes, nearly. Sticky toffee gulab jamun.
And so what? I get the sticky toffee concept. Tell us about the dessert.
So gulab jamun is probably one of the most iconic and popular Indian desserts. And it's small balls of dough made of milk powder and they're fried. So kind of similar to a donut. And then authentically, they're soaked in a like rose and cardamom syrup. But I skipped that step and basically soaked it in a sticky toffee pudding sauce instead to combine two of my favorite desserts.
Well, you had me at kind of like a donut. That sounds fantastic.
Yeah.
And I wonder, just getting back to your Instagram, what kind of feedback do you get from people out there? Are there people swapping recipes or telling you, well, this is how we do it in our family or our community?
I think my followers and my Instagram page is a really nice community of people sharing recipes. And I'm from Pakistan, which is just one country in South Asia. So everyone has their own way of cooking certain dishes. So I'll have Bangladeshi followers telling me how they do something in their family and Indian followers telling me how they do something. So it's actually really nice to be able to share recipes and share notes.
Zaida, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. It's been fun.
That's Zaina Din. She joined us on Food Friday to talk about her new cookbook. It's called Desified, Delicious Recipes for Ramadan, Eid, and Every Day. As we heard, recipes inspired by Pakistan, India, a little bit of England, and around the world there. You can also follow her on Instagram at Zaina's Bakes and find some good cooking inspiration for Ramadan and all the year long. Still love to hear from you. If this is part of your family tradition we've been talking about, if you're getting ready to observe Ramadan and have some foods you want to tell us about, let us know. You can email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. And if you have a recipe to share, love to see it. I think I might try to make that naan recipe this weekend. I had no idea it was so easy, and I love that stuff. Coming up Monday on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, get the latest on the so-called fake elector plan here in Wisconsin in 2020, where Republicans signed elector documents and submitted them to various official institutions. The latest news in a legal settlement, a bunch of documents were released. Our own Rich Kramer has been digging through those documents, figuring out what we learned from that situation. He'll join Kate, and you could join the conversation with your reactions to that news, your thoughts, your questions about what we've learned along the way. Join that conversation. It's coming up Monday morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hey, here's a reminder, since it snuck up on me this year, daylight savings time starts this weekend. So early Sunday morning, or maybe just when you get up on Sunday, set all those clocks forward an hour. This one is the annoying time change because it effectively takes away 1 hour of our weekend. Sleep, that can be an issue here. Maybe go to bed a little earlier tonight to get ahead on the adjustment. And of course, we want everybody to be on the same page, so you tune in at the right time on Monday for this show. And if you're going to be a guest on Central Time next week, please definitely make sure you are in the right time frame. Keeping up with the latest, 23 hours a day, this is Central Time. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. And last night's State of the Union address, President Joe Biden didn't mention former president and presumptive Republican nominee Donald Trump's name, but he did reference his likely opponent in the 2024 presidential race many times, using the phrase "my predecessor." He cited policy and character differences with Trump and the previous administration, as well as more recent statements from Trump.
A former Republican president tells Putin, quote, "do whatever the hell you want." That's a quote. A former president actually said that, bowing down to a Russian leader. I think it's outrageous, it's dangerous, and it's unacceptable.
Meanwhile, on the campaign trail, Trump faces felony charges, 91 of them, and the timelines of those cases could have an impact on the 2024 campaign. Looks like a Biden-Trump race is for sure now after a Super Tuesday win by both candidates. We're going to check in on that, on the State of the Union, Trump's trials, and how they fit into the overall campaign. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What were your thoughts on the State of the Union address last night? Did you like what you saw from President Biden? What stood out to you? What questions do you have about former President Trump's charges against him, civil cases, criminal cases? As a voter, do they matter when it comes to the election in November to you? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. David Schultz is Distinguished University Professor and Winston Folkers Endowed Distinguished Faculty Chair at Hamline University in the Departments of Political Science, Legal Studies, and Environmental Studies. David, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me again. It's always a pleasure to be here.
Let's start with last night's State of the Union address. Yeah, sometimes these are laundry lists of every little thing our administration has done, whoever the president might be. Did this feel more like a campaign speech than usual to you, David?
This was definitely a campaign speech, and I think the president had to do two different things, and I'll be curious to see what the listeners think. I think first, he had to draw a contrast between himself and Trump, and I think he did that last night. Whether people are persuaded by it, I don't know. But the second thing that I think he needed to do was to deliver it in a way to start to try to address the issues regarding his age and health. Because one of the things that I think we have to admit, especially after the special prosecutor a few weeks released a report deciding not to go after Biden because of the documents issue, people have been talking about beyond a whisper about is Biden too old? Is he up to being president of the United States? And I've seen conflicting reports back and forth. And again, I'll be curious from your listeners. Some people are saying that he pulled it off last night. He gave enough to sort of reassure the public that he's got the vigor to be able to do it. Others said, no, didn't do it. Or he came across as an angry old man. But certainly he had to worry about both the message and the delivery. And again, we're going to see over the next few days, according to the polls, what the public thinks.
To what extent do State of the Union addresses matter in an election year? It was 8 months out for the actual election itself. Do we tend to remember these things when it comes to November?
Generally, we don't remember them, and they kind of become, I guess, footnotes somewhere along the line. But this one, I think, was kind of important in a way because, again, we've got all these controversies swirling out there about his health, about, and again, even among Democrats. I think what the New York Times released a poll late last week that said that a majority of Democrats think he's too old to be president of the United States at this point. So I think he needed to do something to start to change the narrative, because I do think that the narrative right now is the story about his age, about, again, his capacity, his stamina, maybe his mental acuity to stay on as president. So I think he needed to start to address that. And I also want to say at some point, you know, he did something smart. He put his age out there front and center and talked about it in reference to the fact that he was a very young senator. And now with age comes wisdom. Again, whether he has convinced people, I don't know. But I think he had to start to do that now.
Let's bring in a caller at 800-642-1234. Artis is with us in Pewaukee. Artis, hi.
They talked about it. They referenced that he was a very young senator. And now...
I'm just hearing Artis's radio, I think. Well, let's put Artis back on hold and see if we can get that squared away. We're talking to David Schultz from Hamline University, looking at the presidential race. David, we are talking about this now. We got the State of the Union. We'll get to the Trump charges in just a bit. This is a pivotal week in some ways. I think up until maybe Super Tuesday, there was the vague thought that we could have something other than a Trump-Biden race, as unlikely as that seemed. We've got a Biden-Trump race now, right? That's just what we got.
We do at this point, because the main challenger to Donald Trump was Nikki Haley, and she bowed out the day after Super Tuesday. And at the same time, not that there was much of a challenge, but Dean Phillips, who represents the state of Minnesota, who's a congressman in Minnesota, not far from where I live, was also the main challenger. And he has also bowed out. And in his case, he's endorsed Biden. Haley has not yet endorsed Trump, which will be an interesting question here. But the other thing which is important, and again, this is the state of Minnesota, and we had in Minnesota about 19% of the people who showed up to vote cast a vote for uncommitted here, much like what we had in Michigan. The other side of, let's put it this way, the other border state to Wisconsin, we had a couple of weeks ago, what was it, about 100,000 voters, if I remember correctly, also voted non-committed. And so one of the issues here is, even though it does look like Trump versus Biden, unless something totally unexpected happens here, we've got a certain segment of the Democratic Party population concerned about Biden in terms of his issues with Gaza and Israel. And we have a certain percentage of the Republican population voters, maybe 30, maybe 40%, who are not completely behind Trump. So for two individuals, Trump and Biden, who are essentially both running as incumbents, they don't have their entire parties behind them right now, even though they face no serious opposition. And it'll be curious to see over the next few months how both of them do their best to try to, let's say, get their parties, their bases, everybody behind them, because both candidates need full energy of their bases and full support of their bases if they're going to win the election.
Let's go to our callers now. Willem is with us in Colfax. Willem, hi.
Hi. As far as the candidates go, I think, you know, Joe Biden, you might disagree with his policies, but I think he's a decent person. Where on the other hand, the former president is already saying that if he doesn't win re-election, it'll be another stolen election. So he's already inciting the riot that he did on January 6th. He has 91 felony indictments. He's been convicted of sexual assault. He's no longer allowed to do business in the state of New York. He lies as easily as he breathes. So the party of Lincoln, Honest Abe, has become the party of
a ridiculous liar like Donald Trump.
Well, thanks for the call. One clarification there. Trump wasn't convicted of sexual assault. In a civil case, a jury ruled that he was liable and had committed sexual assault. Slight legal distinction, but important, I think, David. But Willem, bringing up the felony convictions, another thing we were hoping to talk to you, or felony charges, right. Excuse me, another thing we had hoped to talk to you about. What are you watching most closely? We've got all these different cases making their way through the court system now.
Yeah. First off, again, just to remind everybody, there's been no conviction again. Right. And Donald Trump is entitled to the presumption of innocence until proven guilty, just like everybody else. And so we just want to clarify that here. But yes, there's still four possible trials along with 91 convictions. One of them is on hold right now. This is the one surrounding the events of January 6th. That is the one in which the case has been appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court, where Trump is arguing that he enjoys absolute immunity from prosecution for actions that he committed while president of the United States. The Supreme Court just announced recently they're going to take the case. Briefs are due later this month. Oral arguments are due in April, decision likely by the end of June. So we're going to find out on that one in terms of what's going to happen. If the court were to say that he can still he doesn't have immunity and face trial, I could see that trial occurring in sometime in September or October. So that's a possibility. There's three other trials, by the way, too. We've got a trial later this month in New York surrounding his payoff through Michael Cohen to silence Stormy Daniels, the adult film star. And then we have the case in Atlanta, which is scheduled probably at some point in the next couple of months, perhaps, all depending on what happens down there. But then there's also the case that is down in Florida regarding his retention of documents at the Mar-a-Lago, his estate there. That case, as well as the New York case, should not be affected by the Supreme Court's ruling one way or the other about immunity. And so those are probably going to still go through. Again, the New York one, I think, later this month. I suspect the one in Florida in the next 2 to 3 months is going to happen. And then we're just going to have to see on the other two in terms of, you know, timing or how the Supreme Court's views on immunity affect things. But what I want to point out here is there's always a phrase that people use called what? The October surprise, and something that could happen in October. And I want to throw out two possibilities here. One of them is I think one of the October surprises could very well be something happens in October regarding a trial for Trump, possibly. But remember, there's still a presumption here, possibly a conviction. I think another October surprise that could change things is the status of the Gaza-Israeli war. And then what I'm finding interesting, and tell me what you think also, I'm increasingly hearing people say to me, do you think one or both of them might have to pull out of the race because of health reasons? And that's a possibility too. I mean, so I think we've got two or three possible October surprises that could happen.
We're talking about last night's State of the Union address, as well as looking at some latest news around civil and criminal cases against former President Trump, all as the presidential race solidifies Biden versus Trump. Our guest is David Schultz from Hamline University. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or questions on those issues. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation, hear from you coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with David Schultz from Hamline University, looking at the 2024 presidential campaign, the State of the Union, the latest in charges against former President Trump. Let's go to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Artis is with us in Pewaukee. Artis, hi.
Hi. As far as Biden goes, I've never had a problem with him. I'm not going to get it. I mean, I know he's not perfect, but the thing about it is, you know, did I watch the State of the Union? I'm so anxious that Trump will win. I don't think there's anything that can stick to him. Even if he got a conviction, even if he got 91 convictions, it just nothing seems to stick to him. And the idea of him becoming president again, I mean, it's bad enough that he's on the planet, but it scares me to the point where I can't deal with it. I will vote, But I can't, you know, when I watch any, the last election cycle, I watched every bit of it.
Artist, I gotcha. David, what do you think?
Well, I think she speaks for a lot of people across the United States in a variety of different ways. Again, public opinion polls are telling us, if they're accurate, that about 60% of the American public is not particularly thrilled about seeing a Trump versus Biden, you know, lineup again. And to make more specific to the caller who just came in here, there is still, and I think this is in part what Biden is counting on the fact that there's an awful lot of people, even if they don't like Biden himself, so dislike Donald Trump, that's going to help propel Biden into the White House again. And that's a possibility. The other thing that I think this what's really interesting about Donald Trump at this point is how do people like Donald Trump and Joe Biden really raise the issue about character, you know, and where does character or people's personal lives at all fit into how the public evaluates people for office? And I think that's what the caller is also talking about here is, again, I don't want to put words in her mouth, mm-hmm. but she's saying, how could somebody who has done X, Y, Z even be considered president of the United States? And I think that's an interesting question.
Artist, thanks for the call. Nate joins us now in Milwaukee. Nate, hi.
Hi, thank you for having me. I watched both the State of the Union and the response. From this response, she called Biden dithering in the State of the Union itself, though. He didn't strike me as dithering. And one of the things that I appreciated about his State of the Union is that he referred to supporting Ukraine as something the Congress ought to get done, because the Congress has been dithering on that. And most people think that as a country that has been under attack, Ukraine basically should be helped because it's the right thing to do, and it also helps make the U.S. safer in the long run.
Nate, thanks a lot for the call. David, there was a lot of that focus on aid to Ukraine in the speech, a split in among Republicans in Congress over that issue. How important an issue do you see that in the presidential campaign, though?
Probably not a big issue. I think it's still going to be mostly the issues about the economy, where most people are thinking about the economy in terms of the inflation. I think it's going to be about abortion rights. I think that's going to be where the big focus is. But I think and Biden tried to lay out other items on the agenda, too, in terms of what is out there. But where I do think Ukraine fits in at this point is in terms of a question all about the national security issues, because Biden is, as in the clip that you folks played at the top of the show here, I believe, Biden is going to try to make Trump sound as if he's in Vladimir Putin's pocket and is going to squeeze him and the Republicans on the Ukraine issue. And I'll be just curious to see, you know, how that plays out, because right now, you're right, the majority of American public, and actually the majority of Congress, wants to provide funding to Ukraine. But I just don't think right now it's risen to the top to where people are going to say this is a make or break issue for us in terms of voting.
Nate, thanks for the call. Jimmy is with us now in Valley Junction. Jimmy, hi.
Good afternoon, gents. I didn't watch the State of the Union. There's just too much rancor and antics by the Republican side. It's just kind of a waste of time for me. I guess he did a good job. I'm not worried about his age. People have to, you're going to have to suck it up. We got what we got. There's nobody riding in on the horse to save the day. And if they did, what are they going to do? Kick Kamala Harris to curb? Yeah, that'd be a civil war in the Democratic Party. So you vote for Joe, he goes through halfway through his second term, retires. Kamala Harris becomes president, first female and woman of color president. And I'll take my comments off the air.
Jimmy, thanks for the call. Not the most rousing endorsement there, David, but Jimmy sees a path through the next couple of years.
He does, I think, at this point. And I think he speaks for a certain segment of the Democratic Party in terms of saying that Joe Biden is still our candidate. He's still better than the alternative. Vote for him. He's also the caller is trying to address what I think are some murmurings out there where some people are saying, well, should Biden keep or not keep Kamala Harris? Because if you look, again, public opinion polls, there is a lot of concern among some of the voters regarding whether or not Kamala Harris is qualified to be president. And with many people, again, still concerned about Joe Biden's age, I think what's really happening here is people are saying, well, if something were to happen to Biden, she's president. Is she qualified? And this is reminiscent of back in 2008 when John McCain picked Sarah Palin to be president of the United States. People were concerned back then regarding whether John McCain would live out 4 years, and the focus was on her in terms of her qualifications. And there's some evidence that Sarah Palin's hurt John McCain among centrists and moderates. She might have helped him among the core base, but she was an example of where a vice president candidate might have mattered because of her qualifications.
Thanks for the call. Sarah joins us now in Libertyville, Illinois. Sarah, hi.
Hi there. So I know some people personally and a lot of others online that I've talked to about how they're going to vote third party, like either for Robert Kennedy or the Green Party. And they like don't believe, they specifically have said that they don't believe that Trump is going to do these like really certain things that he has said that he's going to do, like institute Project 2025, which is going to just, well, I don't have time to go into that, but also, and then policies that the New York Times reported on that Stephen Miller crafted, they had an interview with him mm-hmm. about deporting every single undocumented person, rounding them up, putting them in camps.
Sarah, I gotcha. Thanks for the call. Just a minute or so left, David. Immigration, there's the third party issue, but Sarah, at the end, they're talking about immigration and the border, obviously a huge issue in the speech right. And for Republicans.
Yeah, I should have included that among the top issues, again, in terms that seems to be moving the American public. Again, abortion, the economy, and the border issue in terms of securing it. I think that's a major issue that's affecting lots of people. And this is also an issue that's affecting what's happening in Congress, because there was a deal that was brokered by the Senate, bipartisan. The House didn't bring it up to vote. And it's also this deal regarding the border that's tying up issues regarding, whether you like it or not, aid to Israel, aid to Ukraine. So the border issue, I think, is a big one. And you're going to hear, I think, Trump talk about it and Biden accuse Republicans and Trump of saying you're standing in the way of resolving this issue.
Thanks for that call. And David, we'll leave it there. Thanks, as always, for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you very much. And thank you to the audience.
That's David Schultz, distinguished university professor at Hamline University in the departments of political science, legal studies, and environmental studies. Talked to him about last night's State of the Union address and the states of the major legal cases against former President Trump, how it all fits into the 2024 presidential campaign. Coming up Monday here on Central Time, private equity firms have bought up newspapers around the United States and cuts and closures have followed. Find out more with the author of the new book, Hedged, How Private Investment Funds Help Destroy American Newspapers and Undermine Democracy. Plus, we'll dig into the big winners from Oscar night. That's coming up this weekend. And we'll get some advice on which movies we should catch up on if we missed them before the award show. You can make your predictions and picks right now. Email your favorite movies of the year at ideas@WPR.org. Again, that's ideas@WPR.org. Then join that conversation. It's all coming up Monday here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, the author of a new book tells us what we can gain by embracing uncertainty in a world that demands quick answers. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.